Okay, thank you. Yeah, so we heard a lot about theories and so, but I tried to put together the arguments why possibly binaries and other, I mean not the single star models, might give good explanations of how long gamma ray bursts are formed. The very important part, which I think I stressed personally very many times in the talks here, is this new thing which we saw during the meeting and which also Maurice showed yesterday, is the question of the host galaxies. This paper by Früchter et al., for which we had been waiting for many years because Andy is not very fast in publishing, and which was also here reviewed by Andrew Levan, the second author of the paper, is this question that the hosts of the long gamma ray burst are quite peculiar. There is only one grand design spiral. The crosses are positions which have the accuracy, the resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope, so that's about 1/20th of an arc second. The other, the circles, are the ones where the position is given by the size of the circle. And what came out of this is that, yeah, you have only one spiral, 41 of these disturbed little galaxies with large blobs of light indicating star formation, starburst, interacting little galaxies apparently, for some reason going into a starburst. And they compared that with the Goetz sample of core collapse supernovae with similar types of redshift, and they found there that about half of the core collapse supernovae occur in spirals and the other half occur in these little galaxies. So that's very different from what you see for the long gamma ray bursts. Picture is very different. And as Andrew Levan showed also is this graph, if you look at the pixel from where where the gamma ray burst or the supernova was located, and you look what fraction of the pixels is fainter than that pixel in the galaxy, then you see that in the core collapse supernovae, the red graph, it's just 50%, and so they are just following the average light of the galaxy, while if you look at the long gamma ray burst, you see that most of the pixels of the galaxy are fainter than the pixel where the long gamma ray burst is located. So you get a very different cumulative histogram of the locations and the light. Particularly, they're much more concentrated on the light, on the bright light of the host galaxy. So they seem to be closely correlated with the star bursts happening in the small galaxies. I think this is a very important picture here. Excuse me?
Couldn't it be a problem of frequency? The fact that the brighter region, there are more stars and it will more chance to.
Yeah, but why wouldn't you see that with the normal core collapse supernovae? So they differ very much from the normal core collapse supernovae. Now, core collapse supernovae. So the normal core collapse supernovae in the little galaxies as well as in the grand design spirals just follow the average light. That is basically what this picture shows. While this, the long gamma ray bursts clearly are concentrated on the brighter parts.
So I have a question on this then. If I just took the supernova that were in these weird small galaxies,
they follow the average
on the line, or would they be peaked toward the? I mean, is this a repeat of the comment that they tend to be in smaller radar galaxies, or is it a new piece of information above
them? I think these follow just. I mean, these are the ones from the second picture.
But it's both the spiral ones and the smaller.
It's a combination of the two.
Yeah, if I just looked at the irregulars,
alone. I don't know that, actually. I've not seen a picture of that.
At some point, these small regulars are so small that you're almost always guaranteed to be, you know, if you're in the galaxy, you're guaranteed to be, you know, almost guaranteed to be right near these.
Yeah. I that part I do not know. I have not seen in that paper whether they have looked at that. I don't know.
I mean, they don't have that much statistics at that point.
So. There were only 16 of them, yeah, so it's 50-50. Eight are in the spirals and eight are in these small galaxies. But if you look at the picture, I would say, in some of them they are also on the bright spot, it looks like. But,
Yeah, I would argue that the ones in the small regulars are the ones that are the top of the supernova bunch. They're the ones that are on that right side of the plot, I guess.
Yeah, but 16 objects, I mean, it's not a huge sample.
It's not a huge sample, but still.
It would be important to make this exercise.
Yeah.
Because
it's a good idea, but I don't know it. I don't know it. Anyhow, I try to interpret this. And, first of all, core collapses, what do they make? And this is a plot from Chris here, who did calculations of the remnant masses after core collapse for solar metallicity as a function of initial stellar mass, the remnant mass. And it looks like, so maybe up to 18 or 20 you get neutron stars, and above that you get black holes. This is for zero metallicity and taking stellar winds and so into account. And the solar metallicity, the remnants are much smaller in mass than with zero metallicity. But anyhow, I would say the normal core collapses, say like normal type 2 supernovae or the not so luminous 1B1Cs, I would guess they come largely from the lower mass type of stars, so the ones in the last picture. And so if you make an exercise, if you just look at the IMF and you say roughly the 8 to 20 solar mass stars, maybe it should be 18 or a little below, probably form neutron stars and pulsar, then about 3/4 of all the core collapses come from these 8 to 20 solar mass stars, and about 1/4 come from more massive stars, and about 1/6 above 30 solar masses. Now, if you look at those pictures of these hosts, then it looks like the core collapses of the core collapse supernovae were typical type 2s, I understood, and a few type 1B1Cs, about 15%, I understand. So the bulk would come from this 8 to 20 solar mass stars. That's my interpretation of that. And that seems then they are not particularly favored for small starburst galaxies over grand design spirals. It's 50-50. But if you look at these long bursts, then they are enormously strongly favored in these small starbursts, LMC, SMC-like galaxies. And if we look particularly at the hosts of the supernova gamma ray burst that we know, 1998 BW, the size of that was a paper by the Danish group, Solomon et al., is about the size of the Large Magellanic Cloud. The host of this new one, which went off during our meeting here, is, Hélène Pian told me, is the size about the Small Magellanic Cloud. The host of 03-03-29 was undetectable, so that must be very small, less than the Small Magellanic Cloud. And also the host of the very first identified one, it also had a supernova bump, but that's at high redshift. It was certainly smaller than the Large Magellanic Cloud, so it looks like it is indeed small galaxies. Now, just how does a starburst look like? There was this nice paper by Hatfield and Krauter just recently. They looked at a nearby starburst galaxy, which you can very well study. It's near to us, NGC 3125. And it has the same metallicity as the Magellanic Clouds, roughly. It has 7,200 O stars from their study. And there are A number of them are in clusters, big clusters of hundreds of thousands of solar masses, about 600 O stars per cluster. And if you take just the IMF, you see that about 5,400 of the O stars are typically stars more massive than 20. Yeah? That's where the O stars begin. So then 5,400 more than 25 and 4,300 more than 30. And that's a lot of stars, because if you look at the total number of O stars in our galaxy, that's about estimated to be 20,000. And so this small galaxy has about one third of all the O stars which are galaxies. So they make a lot of stars, and very massive ones. And so, just to repeat what I already said, it looks in the grand design spirals and the small galaxies that the numbers of stars collapsing from this 8 to 20 solar mass range, these are the frequencies about the same, and above that there is something very different. But you would expect, just extending the main sequence here, that the numbers of stars collapsing to black holes must be roughly the same in these galaxies, because if the 8 to 20 solar mass collapses are roughly the same, also above that it must be roughly the same. And this stresses once more that long gamma ray bursts are really only a very small subset of the black hole forming supernovae. It's only a very small fraction, and for some reason they very much favor these small galaxies. Now, by the way, this is also confirming what Nomoto told at our meeting here, and also in earlier papers, looking at the very energetic supernovae that are associated with gamma ray bursts 1998 BW and the one of March 2003, that the progenitors seem to be coming from 30 or more solar masses. So as these starburst galaxies have lots of stars above 25, 30, I would guess that that indicates to us that indeed these long gamma ray bursts must come in some way or another from these very massive stars. Now, the same frequency of core collapse supernovae in small galaxies and in large, in grand design spirals, does not mean that the frequency per galaxy is the same, because you have to fold in the luminosity function of the galaxy. And typically the luminosity function, what I heard here from talk by Nakar, goes with L to the minus 2, and since the luminosity is for a galaxy is proportional to the mass, this would go with the mass to the minus 2. Now, I don't know exactly the mass of the Large Magellanic Cloud. I looked through the literature. Some optimistic people say it's one-tenth the mass of our galaxy, but that seems a bit much. Others say about 1/20. I've taken, just looking at the size and the luminosity, 1/20 seemed like a reasonable guess for the mass of the large cloud, and the small one is a little bit smaller, about 1/30. And so with that luminosity function, you would have 400 times more galaxies like the LMC and 900 as the SMC than our own type of galaxies, the grand design spirals. Now, if the star formation would occur at the same pace per unit mass in all these type of galaxies, you would expect 20 to 30 times more core collapse supernovae in these small galaxies, because there are so many more and their mass is 1/30, so then you get this 20 to 30 times more. But you see the same rate, and that means that they go only from time to time through a starburst. Now, we don't know exactly how long a starburst lasts, but since this is a tidal effect between galaxies or collisions, and such a collision, I would think, would at least take some 40 million years or something like that, then you have to multiply that by about 20 to 30 to see how often it happens, and then you would get, say, roughly one of these starbursts in a billion years. Then you would get the same core collapse supernova rate in the collection of these small galaxies and in the grand design spirals. But still, these small galaxies, for some reason or another, make 40 times more long gamma ray bursts. So what could be the reason for that, and well, of course, we heard that already quite a lot of time in this meeting. Something people immediately think of is, of course, the relation to metallicity, because the small galaxies always have smaller metallicities because of their different evolution from large galaxies, and the large cloud 1/3 solar and the small cloud about 1/5 solar. If you look at stellar wind measurements in stars, in supergiants and so, in the Magellanic clouds, recent thesis of one of my PhD students, who will get his thesis within a month now, he finds that it goes roughly to z to the power 0.78, but you have to put in about an error of about plus or minus 0.20 there, so it could be also going with z to the power 1/2, but in any case the wind's mass loss rates are lower. Now, we saw already also from the plot of Chris, the theoretical plot, you expect if you have wind and higher metallicity, the black holes get smaller, and I would expect also that you get more black holes with low metallicity because the stars just lose less mass, and so they have a larger probability to finish as a black hole. Now the LMC, the numbers are very small, there are only 4 high mass X-ray binders in the LMC, but half of them have a black hole. And in our galaxy we know only one, Cygnus X1, out of more than 20 of these classical high mass X-ray binders. So it seems that black hole production at low metallicity is more efficient than at our galaxy's metallicity. Also what helps, of course, is you get less angular momentum loss if you have less wind, so you lose less of your angular momentum. But you can also think along a completely different line, because you see these long gamma ray bursts to happen, particularly in the starburst galaxies, so it might also be something related to a starburst. And a starburst might produce different objects than you find in normal continuously star-forming galaxies. For example, in a starburst galaxy like M82, you find these massive young globular clusters, and you find them in the Antennae galaxy, you find lots of these young globular clusters. So if you have a starburst, you may form objects which you do not make in our own galaxy. And in a normal continuously star-forming galaxy where you just make open clusters and things like that, but not these massive, these huge massive star clusters. And Shree's idea is that maybe the long gamma ray bursts are something special having to do with these massive young star clusters. So that's a totally different way of thinking of progenitor. Now just looking at the Z-related possibilities, then of course, as we heard in our meeting many times, you need some extra things to make a long gamma ray burst. You need a rapidly rotating core at the time of the collapse, and Woolsey and McFadyen have this specific angular momentum condition somewhere between 3 and 20 times 10 to the 16 CGS. And from the observations we know that these long gamma ray burst supernovae have no hydrogen and helium. Well, maybe there could be helium, because I understand the shock wave could turn the helium completely into nickel. But in any case, they don't have hydrogen, so you must have lost the... you must not have a hydrogen envelope. And then, of course, as we heard, there are two possible scenarios to get this combination of high specific angular momentum of the core and no observable hydrogen-rich envelope. One is rapidly rotating massive stars which are rotationally mixed, so they evolve homogeneously, as Jung and Langer were the first, I think, to propose, and also now there is a paper by Woolsey and Hager which look exactly at this type of model. You have the low metals, so the wind is weak, so you do not lose much angular momentum. You completely mix the star during the evolution, so in the end it is a helium star, and so you get a rapidly rotating helium star at the time of collapse, and that might make this long gamma ray burst. But the totally different way is to say, okay, I have low metal abundance, so the winds are weak. And if there is no rotational mixing, the only way to get the envelope off is by binary interaction. Because in mass exchange in a binary, you can get rid of the hydrogen envelope. If you do it later in the evolution, when the star has already a helium core, or it is even further than that. And this was looked at by Izard et al. And Podziatlovsky and company. They assume that you have a small companion, and when the star is a giant, you get common envelope evolution, the companion spirals in, and you get a very close binary consisting of the helium core and this companion, and the envelope has been thrown off. And then the companion helps to give you large rapid rotation of the helium star. So if you assume that it's tidally, the tidal spin-up time is short, and that you can synchronize it, then you might make a rapidly rotating helium core, which then can possibly collapse and make this long gamma ray burst. Now, this is, you have seen such pictures already before, so this is about the single rotationally mixed stars. This is one of the calculations by Jung and Langer, but as I said, also now Woosley and Hager have one of those. So this completely homogeneous evolution, this is for a 40 solar mass star with a very low metal abundance, in this case 10 to the minus 4, which is very low. This star still loses something like 8 solar masses. It starts as 40, it loses 8 solar masses during its evolution, and at the end, it's when it collapses the outside, it looks like a helium star. And it does not lose that much angular momentum, so in this case you would be able to have enough angular momentum in the core. In this model, the coupling of the differentially rotating, when the star evolves, the coupling of the differentially rotating layers is made by the Sprout magnetic coupling mechanism. But now the binaries, if you spiral in, you start out with a high initial orbital separation, but in the end, if you want the shortest possible orbital period for this binary consisting of a helium star plus the companion, if this companion is a main sequence star, then the condition is that the companion should not overflow its Roche lobe. It cannot be larger than that, because otherwise they will completely merge. So if you want to keep a binary, and it turns out if you have something like a one solar mass companion, then the orbital period, the minimum you can get is something like 10 hours about, of that order. Now if you start out with that separation and you try to calculate then what the initial separation must have been, just using this common envelope formalism which Webbing used, this is just an energy formalism. You assume that the drop in orbital potential energy is just the binding energy of the envelope. So by releasing this gravitational energy, you kick out, you eject the envelope. Then this, you have a formula for that. And if you plug in all the different constants which are in there, which are of order unity, this is the mass of the big star, the core of the big star, this is the mass of the big star, this is its envelope mass, and this is the mass of the little companion. And if you say I take a 30 solar mass star with a 10 solar mass helium core and a 1 to 2 solar mass main sequence companion, then it turns out that the initial separation must be of the order of several astronomical units. So you must have really a wide supergiant binary to keep at the end this helium core with this little star. And this is in each such paper, you find this. They assume that these stars will be tidally synchronized, but I think you have to calculate that. And lucky enough, there were also people here who knew about tidal forces who helped me getting the right references. The question is, can these binaries do it with the main sequence companion? And I give already the answer, probably not, but I'll come to that, because the ideas of Izard et al. And Podziatlovsky et al. Was that they can do it. You get a rapidly rotating core by this tidal spin up, the helium core. And they say, okay, then when this helium star explodes and the core collapses to a black hole, you get something like the progenitors of these soft X-ray transients, the black hole X-ray binaries with low mass companion stars. And a famous one is this one, Nova SCO 1994, which has an F subgiant companion and a black hole of more than about seven solar masses. It's relativistic jets and whatever during the outburst. That one has this pollution with alpha elements on the surface by a factor of 10 increased abundance of oxygen, neon, magnesium, sulfur on the surface, also titanium, I think. And so Podzielowski et al. Suggested that basically all these guys came from gamma ray bursts, from long gamma ray bursts. But we. It could be 1999, yeah. I'm sorry if I had the year wrong. It could be 1999, yeah, sorry, yeah. I just did it from the top of my head, so this was not. Well, he published also something in 2000, but that was in a symposium which I organized. But the Nature paper is from the year before. You're absolutely right. So, but actually, we think Jung's calculations seem to suggest that this cannot work, and I will at least cannot work that the progenitors of these guys were necessarily long gamma ray bursts. Of course they were collapsing objects which collapsed to black holes, because we have black holes in there, but whether they really gave a gamma ray burst is not so sure, I think. Now, you have to calculate the tidal synchronization times, and I used Zahn's calculations, Zahn's model for that for convective stars, and he gives a time scale in which you have an orbital period to a certain power, the mass ratio, this depends just, Q is the mass ratio of the two stars, and then this factor comes from his calculation. So if I have a main sequence companion of 1 or 3 or 6 or 8 solar masses, and I have helium stars here of 4, 8, 16, 4, 8, 16, etc., then the orbital periods are typically around 10 hours to 15 hours to have the star fill its Roche-Lobe and not be larger than its Roche-Lobe. And you see that these are of the order of thousands of years, but in this formula you assume the total radius of the star. But in a helium star, only the convective core should be taken into account, and your convective core is smaller than the star, and then you have to multiply this by the seventh power of the radius divided by the radius of the convective core. And for an 8 solar mass helium star, this is about a factor 20, and for a 16 solar mass helium star, it's about a factor 10. But so the longest time scales are about 100,000 years. And that's not bad, because helium stars live much longer than that, so you can synchronize them. That's not the problem. You can synchronize them in sufficiently short time. On the other hand, if you take a compact companion spiraling in into the massive star and throwing off the hydrogen-rich envelope, then you can go much deeper, because the helium star should now, the limit is that the helium star fills its Roche-Lobe and the other star is going around it. It has no size at all, the compact star, so you don't have to bother about its size. And then it's the radius of the helium star which determines the radius of the Roche-Lobe. And it turns out if you have a 4 solar mass helium star, the shortest period you get is 1.6 hours. 8 solar mass helium star is about 2 hours, and the 16 solar mass helium star is about 2.5 hours. Then the synchronization timescales are very short. You still have to multiply by this factor 10 or 20, but it's most cases it's less than a century, so there is no problem. And you also have a very high specific angular momentum. Now, if you can keep that is order of magnitude more than what you need from this McFadden and Woosley condition, if you can keep that angular momentum, then you would be in business. But the big question is, can you keep that angular momentum? Now, Dr. Jung made calculations of the specific angular momentum distribution in a synchronized helium star with a main sequence companion. In this case, it's a small companion. It's a K-dwarf or something like that, because the orbital period is only 7 hours. And then at the onset of helium burning, you have the black line. And what you need if the star would collapse to a non-rotating black hole is the blue curve, the top blue curve, and if it would collapse to a rotating black hole, then you would need this curve. Now it's above the Kerr curve, so it seems that if the star would be able until the end of its evolution to keep this angular momentum, then you could make a long gamma ray burst. The black one is the synchronized helium star, and the angular momentum distribution in such a star, the specific angular momentum distribution, as a function of the mass coordinate in that star. And if you would like to, say, have the core collapse, say, to a 2 or 3 solar mass core which collapses, if you want it to have so much angular momentum that it will leave a disk behind, then you must be above this curve if it were to become a Schwarzschild black hole, and above this curve if it were to become a Kerr black hole.
It's a maximally rotating
black hole. Yeah.
So the ISCO moves in, so that's the...
Yeah.
You need less angular momentum to hang up.
I understand, but this is an initial condition prior to core collapse.
Yeah, this is at the onset of helium burning. So the star still has to do a lot of evolution after that. But if you would be able to keep this angular momentum for the rest of its evolution as a function of mass, then you would be in business.
This is in the binary.
Synchronized binary with a 7-hour orbital, 7.17-hour orbital period. Yeah. But, and this is, by the way, for a longer orbital period, you have similar. Then it gets lower, of course, because you have less angular momentum. This is, say, if you have a more massive companion, something like 3 or 4 solar masses.
This looks like a capture of a compact object.
This looks like
a capture of a compact object.
No. This is what you get. If you have a main sequence companion, say, if so, after spiral in, you started out with this red or blue supergiant, and the main sequence companion came in, spiraled in completely, and you say the shortest possible orbital period that it can have, and there you synchronize it. And if you do that, and you would have it at the onset of helium burning, then you have such curves. It doesn't matter whether it's a main sequence companion or so, but this is the shortest possible period for this main sequence companion. It could be a compact star also, of course, but as long as you have this period, it means just that the helium star rotates with that period, because you have synchronized it. Now, this is from a calculation by Dr. Yoon. How this helium star further after helium burning, how it evolves in the course of time, the internal structure. This is core helium burning. This is a 10 solar mass helium star. At the end of core helium burning, you are still about 10,000 years from core collapse, which is here. So this is the log of the time until core collapse. And here begins carbon burning. You have contraction of the core in this part, and then carbon and oxygen burning later, and then the collapse. Now here the star is radiative, the core is radiative, and you would expect this sprout mechanism to work. So if the star shrinks in this phase, the core is contracting, and so it will speed up, so it gets into differential rotation, but then of course the sprout mechanism will, if that's operating, it will break the rotation also. And the question is, can you keep this core in the binary synchronized? And that is of course not the case because the core is very small. Let me, oh, what did I do? Did I skip something? Oh. Yeah, the core is very small. It's only 30,000 kilometers, which is 20 times smaller than the outer radius. And since the synchronization time goes with the radius over the core radius to the power 7, the synchronization time becomes very much longer than the evolution time of the star. So you cannot keep this carbon-oxygen core synchronized in the binary. So this core will just contract, speed up, and then it will only be braked again by this mechanism of sprout. And if you take that, Dr. Yoon finds that if you have helium stars of 10 to 16 solar masses, at the time of the core collapse, they have retained about 20% of the specific angular momentum which they had at the beginning of helium burning. If it's a 20 solar mass helium star that lives shorter, it's 40%, and here 40 solar mass helium star, you even retain about 75%. So the star is still differentially rotating very strongly at the time when the core collapses. Now let's go back now. So this is this star. If you would keep it synchronous, the core, if you would have kept it completely synchronous with the orbital motion, then at the onset of helium burning you have again this black curve, and that would be okay as the distribution of specific angular momentum. At the end of helium burning, of core helium burning, it's here, that would still be okay. But at the onset of carbon burning you have the green curve, and then it's much below the minimum that you need. So if you would have kept the core synchronously rotating, the carbon oxygen core, you would never have been able to make a long gamma ray burst. And at oxygen ignition it's even worse.
So let me, before you go, let me understand this plot.
This is just for a completely synchronized,
only at the beginning of helium burning, unsynchronized during helium burning.
No, no, and this is completely synchronized at the end of helium burning.
Okay, so completely synchronized.
And if it's completely synchronized at the moment of onset of carbon burning,
completely synchronized at these different.
And then it does not work.
Okay.
And but lucky enough, as I said, you cannot synchronize it because the core is so small that the synchronization time in the binary of this core is enormously long, and so it goes with the, you have to take 20 to the power 7 times longer than the synchronization time as a helium star, and so the core in the binary cannot be kept synchronized, so it will just contract and speed up, and then it will be braked by the sprout mechanism because it's differentially rotating. But as Dr. Yoon finds, it still retains a sizable fraction at the time of core collapse. It still has retained a sizable fraction of this specific angular momentum it had at helium burning. And so if I take now this helium star in a wide binary, say 5 hours or so, and the angular momentum distribution at the end of helium burning, and now I keep 1/5 of that at the time of core collapse. Now where is 1/5? So I have to go 1/5 down in this curve, so it's 0.7 in the logarithm, that's this arrow, and then I come just below the maximum, the minimum curve that I need for making a long gamma ray burst, to make a disk. And so with a 5-hour binary, you don't do it. And even and if the period is longer, you are not able to do it. So with a main sequence star, you are not able to do it. On the other hand, if I have a 2-hour binary, and that's the same calculation also by Dr. Yoon, then at the end of helium burning, the angular momentum distribution is like this. I retain still about 20% of that specific, and I'm just above the Kerr curve, so I can do it. But you have to have a very short orbital period, otherwise you cannot do it. And so it seems that the only ones where you can do it with is with a compact companion, because here you cannot have a main sequence star.
Well, but the other binary that still works was the original proposal, which is they never got synchronized. They were wide binaries, and the rotation, the binary only removed the hydrogen, and you just stay with the rotation of the fast rotating star. And then it's identical to any single star model as far as its angular momentum.
Repeat that again.
So the original concept we had was the binary was only going to be used to remove the hydrogen envelope.
Okay. And does it rotate fast enough?
And well, then you're stuck with the problem you have as a single star, which is
the Wolf-Rayet wind will carry off angular momentum.
The velocity is low, and it won't carry off enough. So
okay.
That binary one, it gets thrown into the same as the single stars.
Okay. So okay, and then you have removed the hydrogen envelope, so you have already.
That would be wider, wider.
Okay.
Because I mean, I don't know how it goes, how your synchronization goes with radius of the binary, but I assume if I go far enough out.
Then you don't feel it anymore. Yeah, but if you're longer than a couple of days, you will certainly not synchronize a helium star.
Yeah. No. So that's the. Yeah. Those are the two.
Okay.
So you still have that binary option.
Okay. Well, I did not. I didn't think of that. Sorry.
Is there enough angular momentum in the core? Do you have? I mean, we have no idea, right?
Well, this is. I mean.
This at least gives you a sense. It gives you a quantitative result that says what the angular.
But Norbert Langer's Alexander had models that certainly, if I take them. I mean, this is we were doing a project where we were looking at them, and we said, synchronization is actually lower angular momentum than what we get from just the rotation of the star in the first place.
Okay.
You have to assume something for the angular momentum profile of the main sequence star. I mean, these stars rotate rapidly, but we have no idea what the core is doing.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the problem with, I mean, that one gets, this one you can calculate, is a model I can calculate and get numbers, it's a real model.
Yeah.
The stellar evolution single star ones, I can put, if I put in the right angular momentum profile, I get the right answer. But it's a free parameter. That's how I would argue it. Norbert argues the exact opposite. I don't know how. But Norbert would argue that single model with no free parameters is binary model free parameters. So I'm taking the devil's advocate of, I can argue either side and be happy with it.
Anyhow, but the spiraling in binaries, anyhow, the only ones which can really do it are the ones with the compact stars.
When you talk about you have centrifugal hang-up and you make a disk around the Schwarzschild-Kerr black hole, what do you take for the mass of the black hole?
Well, the three solar mass first initial collapse, isn't that so?
I'm sorry. What do you take for the mass of the black hole when you ask the question, do I not form an accretion disk around either a Schwarzschild or the Kerr black hole?
This line, you mean?
Yeah.
I just assume that a given mass.
Yes,
a given mass coordinate. So for instance.
Oh, it is at every mass coordinate. Yeah.
It's calculated for every mass coordinate. Doesn't matter.
So here it's a two solar mass black hole, here a four, and etc.
But if you make that black hole in the core collapse event, is that the picture you're taking, or you just assume that at some point there is a black hole?
Yeah, in fact, I don't know at which, I don't know what
no,
the black hole mass here, but...
If you do form a black hole in the core collapse event, then the property of that black hole is actually, it's created out of this angular momentum distribution.
Yeah,
That's actually what I talked about yesterday. When you use your conservation laws, you can calculate that.
Right.
If you just take a Lane Hamilton distribution or your distribution star and you neglect rotation in this process, you just say, okay, just shell by shell and I make a black hole, then it's not difficult. Right? Exactly where you are.
And this plot, but a lot of your plots are ones where he takes the angular momentum enclosed and the mass enclosed and throw them all into the black hole.
Yeah.
And then it's just one curve.
But here, since I did not really calculate the evolution of the rotation, so I just gave them as a reference.
I find that your two-hour period is really short, because I find you already make disks around the black holes when the period is about 1 day. But then it's true that initially you don't form a disk, so you form a small black hole, and then you have essentially non-accretion modified by the rotation. and there's no hang-up. So the black hole grows very rapidly during this free-fall timescale. But then at some point, you try to accrete the outer layers, and as you know, those are very momentum-rich. So they will stall, actually. So I don't know why you have to go to such enormously small periods to say...
It has to do with the radius of the star, I suppose. You take bigger stars, I suppose, isn't that so?
Well, I scale things, but
yeah.
You can take them 10 solar masses if you wish. I mean, nothing.
But did you take helium stars also?
What do you use for the star structure?
The polytrope. Yeah.
Okay, so that's a.
That's okay, that's, I think.
Well, it's
more or less.
Match a core. So
no.
Which is what he's doing. It's going to be very different than the core.
For the core, it's very different. But for the when you look at higher mass black holes, etc., solar masses, that will have captured a lot of matter from outside the core. So I think for the higher mass black hole, the approximation is not too bad.
So maybe we should look into that more deeply.
I think it's too pessimistic a view that you have to go.
But this is at the moment.
You have to go to such short periods to make anything happen. I'm not quite sure. I think longer periods might do the job.
Well, it's certainly worth
a relevant point
to look into. Yeah.
Well, so can you go back to the one that did not have the.
Which one? This?
This one. So this is where I get confused.
This is completely synchronized with the orbit.
This is a 10-hour one, so this is, you know, even still a shorter orbit than the one day, but...
But this is a very compact core now, huh? And so, yeah, it does not have much angular momentum when it rotates with 10 hours.
Yeah, I mean, my issue is that even if I look at the end of helium burning and I said it was synchronized... So here's the answer. And even if I didn't lose any... more angular momentum at the end of this stage. Can you tell me how I could, you know, this would be where the black hole, this is where I'd start forming a disk.
Yeah.
You know, so for that, at least, that particular model, that particular star, it...
you make a big black hole.
If I don't lose anything, it's six solar masses, and, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, in fact, it's probably bigger because you have less angular momentum than the curved black hole, but since it starts going up quite farther. So this one, this model, 10 hours, I can't even, I won't make a disk until after I've accreted six solar masses.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
no way around it.
That's okay. Right.
Yeah.
So,
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that means you form a pretty heavy black hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is okay. But at the end of the day, it still has a lot of angular momentum, although it's not an extremely curved black hole. It's still fairly rich, not only in its mass, but also in its angular momentum.
Yeah, I don't have probably about I mean, we look at these stars all the time, they're, you know, 0.5, A's of 0.5 and stuff.
Yeah.
But so if the sprout mechanism would not work, then you would just keep this until the end, and then it would be okay. But
even if the sprout mechanism works, you're still just telling me I'm changing it from making a, you know, if I go to 0.2 up there, it starts going up by over an order of magnitude. So you're just slightly moving the mass of the black hole.
Yeah, I'm not so sure if the sprout mechanism, where it works or not works, maybe it's related to your comment, is so relevant, because it's a redistribution of the angular momentum, but if you are accreting a lot of mass in the black hole, then ultimately it all comes together there. Again, you don't lose angular momentum. It's
so basically,
it's a distribution of angular momentum in the star.
But basically you say you could still make a very big black hole here,
yeah.
Even if it's synchronized.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
Star rotation, uniformly rotating stars. Otherwise it's...
Yeah, these are uniformly rotating.
Yeah.
These are uniformly
but
rotating.
But it's helium, so... Okay.
Yeah, that is helium. It's not carbon oxygen
yeah.
there.
So yeah, I mean, there was a bias at some point that it you know, your disk, you want it to be the carbon oxygen stuff and not the helium.
Yeah, yeah.
The problem with the helium is, will it burn?
It'll burn, but it won't do anything.
Yeah, so that is, will it burn or do anything? But
it'll be associated. I mean, when it gets really to the inner region.
Yeah, but it'll burn before it gets to the dissociation region, but the point is it doesn't release enough energy to do anything dynamically.
So, well, okay, that's... Peter Bodenheimer and Stan Woosley said otherwise in the 80s. So that used to be a supernova.
Depends on the depends on the size of the disk. But you're this is a compact, compact.
Well, what are you expecting to do? What do you ask for it?
But if you want
pure hydrogen, you can disrupt the disk.
You can see up to where it's about.
Energy per nucleon.
Carbon is about up to what is it? Six.
Yeah, about six.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess my issue is if I use this Brink mechanism and it moves this, you know, from having a disk start forming here to here, do I care? I mean, maybe that's not quite a factor of five. Certainly, I'll care if this is where I form the disk. If it only starts to form it here, and the angular momentum does this. I know that's probably going to be different. So, but I don't know, if, as long as I have, you know, a few tenths of the solar mass in this region, where it's just going up slowly, do I care?
Yeah, so maybe you could still do it. Yeah.
But, I mean, we don't know. I mean, I'm looking more at your start, but I don't know what's,
Well, we thought we had a nice conclusion, but if you guys are going to kill it again, this is what this workshop is for. But so we thought that this guy could not do it. But yeah, if you run higher up on the mass scale, perhaps it could do it. But in any case, with the 2 hours, there is no problem. You can make the inner core also have the right specific angular momentum. And then I thought, well, how can you make such objects with a helium star and a compact star? Now, it's not so difficult, actually, because we have X-ray binaries in our galaxy, and if you take Cygnus X1, which has only a short orbital period, 5.6 days, but it has a massive black hole, something like 10 solar masses, we do not exactly know how massive the companion is. Some people say it's less than this, but if you ask Gies and Bolton, they would give something like this. Such a star has a 14 solar mass helium core. It's a blue supergiant, orbital period like this. If you let it spiral in, it turns out you can, because of the mass of the black hole so large, that the drop in potential energy, which you get when the orbit shrinks, not that much, you get a lot of potential energy release because this black hole is so massive, and the final orbital period you can get is of the order of 1.5 hours, and the helium star can about do it. It's a little over the Roche lobe here, I think. So Cygnus X1 might make something like that, and there is this other funny X-ray binary with the most massive companion we know, I think, in our galaxy. It is a B1.5 1A0 supergiant. That means that it is a very bright supergiant, almost a hypergiant, Ray 977, on which I spent a lot of observing time also. It's 41 days. It has a neutron star companion. It's one of the slow pulsars. This star certainly must have started out with a mass like that. And if you let that spiral in, you get again something with an orbital period which is something like 1.5 hours. So you can make such systems. I think it's not so difficult to make them. Question is, of course, why would these small galaxies make many more of them than normal grand design spirals? Well, if I would say a helium star plus a black hole, so the remnants like of Cygnus X1. Yeah, if it is true that at solar metallicity, the very massive stars, again, they lose so much mass by wind that when they collapse, they again make neutron stars. And there is some evidence from this Westerland cluster in one of the spiral arms of our galaxy where you have a magnetar, and there are also hypergiants in that cluster, stars of 40 or so solar masses, which seem still to leave a neutron star. So it is possible that these very massive stars at the end, with the solar metallicity at the end, still leave neutron stars again. So we have only a small window where you make black holes. While at low Z, all the stars above a certain mass could make black holes, so you might be producing many more high mass X-ray binaries with black holes in low Z environments. And if you go through the numbers, that could easily enhance the formation of such binaries, the rate of that, by an order of magnitude or more. So small galaxies with the same core collapse rate of 8 to 20 solar mass stars might, as Grandison spirals, might perhaps overproduce these binaries. That might be a possibility. It's pretty speculative, but perhaps this is a possible explanation. Now, this is all I wanted to say about the binaries. And there is this other scenario which Sri Kulkarni brought up here, that perhaps it has to do with the starburst itself and with the fact that you have these massive young clusters. So if you say it has nothing to do with the metallicity or whatever, but it is just the fact that these little galaxies make all these massive globular clusters, yeah, then you could think of dynamical processes in such globular clusters, which you would not find in continuously star-forming galaxies to happen. And of course, in clusters, you think of the most likely interactions, because the cross-sections are of the systems are large, much larger than the star, is binary-binary collisions. And always when you have a binary-binary collision, you get into some very complicated situation for some time, and in the end some stars fly out and other stars may collide. And so if you would have a binary with a black hole and a normal star plus two normal stars colliding, then you might certainly get this situation. And then of course it's possible that the black hole flies to the center of that star, and then you could get one of those models which Chris Fryer has proposed as a possible origin of long gamma ray burst. It's also possible, if it's not a central collision, that you make again a binary of, since the envelope is thrown off in the collision of a helium star and a compact object. This has not been worked out, also not by Sri, but I think it is an interesting possibility, because you have something which is different in these starburst galaxies than in ordinary galaxies. So if I may summarize, I think there are two possible ways to explain the preference for these long gamma ray bursts and small starbursts in galaxies. The first is related to the low metallicity, weak winds, enhanced black hole formation, retaining of angular momentum because of the less mass loss. And then in binary models, the attractive part is that you can easily lift off the hydrogen-rich envelope, which because of the low metallicity you cannot do by winds, and getting the core in rapid rotation at collapse, because binary can help getting this high angular momentum. And up to the discussion this morning, I thought the only viable models are the ones where the companion is a compact object, but maybe we have to look more into detail of that. It seems to be a beginning of a rough conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the end you throw out ones that don't, I mean, we make too many if you are really liberal on how you take them. So at some point you say, which ones are better at giving you angular momentum? And then it's going to be the black hole ones.
Yeah, certainly.
So,
yeah.
So if I'm in a place of riches, then I find ways of saying, well, this one may not work because it's not quite as good. And then I push myself into a smaller. So, I mean, it depends on whether we have too many preventers or not enough.
Yeah. But starburst related, then you certainly have something which would not happen much in normal, continuously star-forming galaxies like our galaxy or so. And then it's something very special. And that's not a bad idea, I think. So I gave my blessing to Sri Kulkarni for his model. This is a picture from a conference a couple of years ago. No, he said I was his guru, so I had to bless him. So anyhow, that's what I wanted to say.
Most preferable to take a black hole to split this up, then the remnant of the GRB would be a black hole at all times.
Yes, yes. Well, I think a neutron star could also do it, but a black hole has more power, of course, with more mass to do the whole synchronization faster.
A neutron star is much more stringently constrained because the common envelope is much more likely to result in a merger.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, almost always results in a merger. I think the rate would be too low.
Well, we have the double neutron star, so you see that there is not always a merger.
You're making a neutron star black hole binary.
Yeah.
And there the rate's probably less than 1 million per year.
Okay.
But then these binaries, these black hole binaries would be very complex.
Yes. You would love them for LIGO. Yeah. Well, Cygnus X1, I think, could do it. I mean, it depends on what the companion is, because you guys have this other model where you make the companion less massive. But, I mean, there might be binaries where the companion is 35.
There aren't any high-mass X-ray binaries known, for instance, that would yield a successful double neutron star according to the standard full common envelope scenario.
The BX-ray binaries?
None of them are wide enough. I don't think there are any that are wide enough. The widest one is 250 days, and that's just maybe...
Well, that's a BE one, but you have also a radio pulsar going around the BE star in 3.5 years, and so, yeah, those guys might do it.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So what will be your expected time of coalescence of this black hole binary?
Oh, I think those would coalesce within a Hubble time, yeah. I don't know what the rate is.
These would coalesce in less than 1 million years.
Yeah.
It was 8-hour orbit? Or no, 2-hour orbit. Yeah, sure. That will be very fast. That would be extremely fast. Yeah.
But then you have to put in the fact that they put in the gamma ray burst and half kicks.
But
that will do it. Yeah. Binary orbit, though. Yeah. To make observation, if we have a single star source, this is your binary source. Observation, how to distinguish them?
That's a difficult one. Yeah, that is a very at cosmological distances. That's not an easy task, I think. Yeah, but both of them are also the single star models are tuned to make a star which has no hydrogen and also has rapid rotation. So yeah, I think it will be.
The duration
would you think?
Well, the coincident gravity wave burst would be the only way to do it if you're willing to wait for 100,000 years.
Yeah, they might want to use them.
I cannot clearly see how to distinguish it from the event itself, because I would think this event would look very similar.
But single star models may have significantly higher zero problems.
Mass, yeah.
Yeah, compared to binaries.
Okay.
Mass should be more.
They may have more what?
Mass.
More zero problems.
Yeah. Zero problems.
Okay.
And also more ejected.
Then I don't know.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because if you start from your 40 solar mass star, you would think also quite a lot of mass ejected. Or does all the mass go into the black hole?
That's difficult to think.
Yeah.
The ejected mass, because in the mass catalog you have,
the problem is your single star
is the long.
Okay.
As well. So depending on your angular mass.
Okay.
Right. So the question is.
Right. Yeah. The question was, there is also this intermediate duration group in the Batzi catalog, which you found and Istvan found, Yeah, so maybe there. Yeah, you mean there could be? You might be. I think theoreticians have to think about that.
So yeah. How does it work out with the event rates if you take this black hole component of stage seriously? would the event rate be sufficient to make the GRB?
So this is where Israel would say no, right?
Yeah, but you know, I mean, in these population synthesis calculations, there go so many assumptions that I don't know how precise. I mean, they produce many more with a main sequence companion close to the helium star, then it's about a factor 40 or so more than with a compact star going around.
What rates do they get? Are they 10 to the minus 4 or 5 per year?
I'm going to go grab the paper.
One solar mass per year star formation?
They with the main sequence companions, they get enough to explain the gamma ray burst rate. This is what they say. So in with their models, this would produce probably too few with the compact star. But I think the uncertainties are pretty big in all those calculations.
Yeah, well, because it's not clear that every successful core collapse will also produce a GRB.
No. We need that rotation.
But,
yeah.
No, even if everything is set in place on this, if you wish, microscopic picture.
Yeah.
Then say the black hole is formed with a large kick velocity. That is not clear to me.
Oh yeah. Then it runs out of the the disk
within a second or so. The high density core.
Yeah.
So there's no chance for an interaction of the black hole with high density matter, which is sort of the least.
It would not drag it around. It would not drag it along?
Well, it will drag it along, but it's a very different accretion process. Having a high momentum accretion onto an accretion disk, so the disk maintains high angular momentum, versus having an off-center accretion of high angular momentum.
Yeah.
Produce probably will make lots of wins and lose much of its angular momentum. And you might just get a messy process of low angular momentum and falling into the black hole, which is not so interesting.
Yeah.
So I think in the fine details there may be sufficient differences that you can have doubt about whether that makes a successful GRB.
Yeah.
And these velocities can easily be a few hundred kilometers a second, so you really need this high density center.
Yeah, so that's
the kick that you get will be the result of accretion in that scenario. So
maybe, but maybe you also have the Bekenstein gravitational radiation recoil reaction.
Not in this scenario, though. That comes from a merger of two complementary mass objects.
No, actually, the original paper looks at what happens if you have a spherical star making the black hole. Then already you can have receive the velocity.
But it's still the coalescence of two comparable mass blobs that make the largest kick, and that's only 200 kilometers per second.
Well, if you form a black hole from a non-ideal, more realistic star, I'm not talking about coalescences of corporate objects.
But that's what it has to amount to ultimately, you know, in terms of if I wanted to apply the relevant formulae to that context. I mean, it has to be, you know, some significant quadrupole that's coalescing on a dynamical time.
Sure, but that can take many forms.
No, I understand.
Partly aerodynamical, partly black hole, maybe the combination, and
I mean, the recoil is pretty weak, as it, you know.
Yeah, but the thing is that the inner region.
Oh, you are reading the Isaac paper.
It's not that large, it's only a few tenths of kilometers. So any kick velocity will allow you to escape on a time scale much shorter than the duration of the GRB that we know of, the long GRBs. So I think it's not really clear what happens. So that's what I'm saying. If you're on the margin with your population synthesis saying, well, this is sufficient to make a GRB, it may not take you all the way because you may have another loss factor in the physics of your
core. I think this is why we'll never understand gamma ray bursts.
So you've read the paper more carefully. I mean, certainly at solar metallicity, they aren't getting the rate. But as you go down to low metallicity, they don't have the relative fraction. I don't see it just glancing at the paper again. Of the fraction of black hole binaries they make. So the issue is that they'll make them, but...
Yeah, it's in a table at the end somewhere.
Yeah, but that's for the... I see a table for solar metallicity.
Oh. Say,
you know, depending on their... What is this, KTG? What is the KTG versus QTG?
The Gilmore.
Yeah.
function.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, mass function.
It's a mass function that levels off below a solar mass.
No, but what they did is they have a mass function for the primaries, and then either they take a flat mass Q distribution, so a flat distribution for the companion mass, or they take them also according to this KTG. That makes an enormous difference, of course.
Shouldn't make that big a difference, because drawing them independently from the IMF is basically a flat mass ratio.
See, that's what I thought too, but they're getting, you know, they get two orders of magnitude different in the rates.
That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, but, you know, life doesn't often. But the issue is they're looking at other systems that they make. They're making like 10 to the minus, in the best case, it's 10 to the minus 3 of all systems are black holes. Which, and the problem is that then the rate is, you know, probably a couple orders of magnitude.
I mean, but the most critical piece of that is, of course, the Kalmanovo of evolution, what they assume for that.
I think they just use the...
But then, you know, for instance, did they use the right binding energy for the star? A lot of people don't.
And there is the point that, you know, I rather like to start from the X-ray binaries, which we already know, because before you make them, there can already be going so many things wrong in this population synthesis.
Anytime you try to make two compact objects, one binary, compounding uncertainties.
So that's why I rather like to start just from the observed binaries with one compact star, because then at least you have some. You can still make mistakes, but not so big as when you start really from the very beginning.
But do they give a rate in there, like an actual number for some star formation rate?
Yeah, they give a rate, but they have a lot of graphs, so you'll have to. I'll make it, because they give a rate as a function of the carbon oxygen mass of the star that then is going to try and make the gamma ray burst. So you can then make your choice of, okay, if the carbon oxygen mass is above this, it's going to make gamma ray burst. If it's below this, it's going to make 1BC supernova. So that's why they give, which is a reasonable thing to do. It's just that if you want a number, it's not on that table, they just give relative fractions. But you got, was your rate high enough? We don't have.
My feeling is that you can, I mean, if you say that in a starburst galaxy you have something like the 7,000 O stars, and if half of them are binaries and things like that, then I think you can, at low Z, if you make more black hole X-ray binaries and stuff like that, I think you could get rates which are okay. But it's just back of the envelope calculations, so I would not put my hand in the fire for it, but on the back of my envelope I got rates which seem okay.
Should normalize it to the ULX frequency. That's, I think, perfectly relevant to these objects.
Yeah.
If you see one ULX, you probably have a lot more black holes there.
Yeah. You would say ULX is a 50 solar mass black hole or something?
Or 10 or 20 solar mass black holes. I think they're stellar mass objects.
Yeah.
I think there's evidence.
Except the one in M82, which is too bright.
There's evidence starting to emerge that even some of the brightest ULXs are not intermediate mass black holes. Some of the stuff that Matt Herpeckhold's been talking about and other things.
Yeah, but this one in M82 is, what is it, 10 to 41 arcs per second?
Yeah, those are monsters, I don't know.
Yeah. If nobody has anything more to say, I think, because I am the last speaker, I would also like to say something. Normally you close all the discussions, but maybe I can have the last word here. I would like to thank you as an organizer for this very pleasant and very interesting meeting. Throughout the whole 3 months that we have been here, you were the person who held the whole program together. I mean, you had some other people helping you, like Ken Nomoto and Sri Kulkarni, but they could be here only a short a fraction of the time, and you were the one who kept us all together, so you were the backbone of this meeting, of this program. And yeah, we have seen many things coming by in the program. In the beginning, we had a lot about supernovae. We had this very nice conference in February. We had Sri's conference in March. A very important thing, of course, is I don't know how you did that, but you organized also that precisely in the middle of the workshop there was this supernova gamma ray burst going off. It was 40 days after the start and 40 days before the end of the workshop. So how you did that? What? Serious connections. But I think there's more to that, because here in California, of course, people strongly believe in all kinds of spiritual things, and I'm sure there must be something more to this that must have some meaning also. So I don't know how you did it, but you did it very well, and it brought even Sri to believe that hypernovae are something special and not just ordinary types of supernovae. So I think that you did a very good thing there. You also socially kept us very good together. I mean, making sure that every week there is a dinner and we get together socially. You're very critical and skeptical, particularly of your own models, I have understood, but lucky enough also of other people's models. I think that is also very good for workshops like this. So. I would like to thank you and also Amy for the very pleasant environment you have created for this program here. And I must say I admire you guys, because you have a full-time job also with two little children, and how you manage all to do that, I don't know. But I would like to thank you on behalf of everybody who has been here and who is still here. Thank you very much for what you have done.